So I was doing some work on a computer today, and there was stuff like rendering. So there was like a progress bar, which you had to wait for it to finish. Which inspired me to write this poem. Progress bar. Progress bar, oh progress bar. You seem so near, yet you are so far. Watching your percentage grow, I feel my beard begin to grow. Progress bar, you are no fun. You make me cook and clean and run. Progress bar, you little bastard. Threats or bribes make you go no faster. Progress bar, your name's a lie. The only progress will be when I die. Progress bar, what are you trying to prove? I've never actually seen you move. Progress bar, now you've gone too far. It's time I progress to the bar.
Thank you, Richard. Brevity, beautiful. From North Carolina, Emily Ransom.
Yeah. Howdy, y'all. So even though I'm from North Carolina, this is a sestina that was written in Ireland by a challenge of a friend back there who asked me if I could write a sestina. So this is written in Carrow Row. The summer drinks in rain and limestone crumbs and nestles in the nettles for a rest beneath wool blankets of her heavy peace. I sought her once, but found my eyes were blind and feet too young to tread her ancient stones, the incarnations of the stuff of time. But summer's cheap possession is her time, the time it takes for sprouts to grow from crumbs or walls to churn the weight of their own stones. So in the pilgrimage that she calls rest, I rubbed my muddy eyes that lingered blind and let her redefine the Irish peace. And on the way I met a man, a piece of tender paper passing like the time between his brittle fingers in his blind routine of ritual tobacco crumbs. He grinned a toga boge, take a rest, and perched to smoke his sculpture on the stones. And as a child, I might have cast some stones, or at the least recited off a piece of dime store jargon, chorted with the rest of my resourcefulness I lost in time. Yet now I sat a spell to cull his crumbs, just young enough at least to know I'm blind. For if there's grace enough to heal the blind, it tumbles down like execution stones beneath the slab where dogs can gather crumbs. And on the coast of Inishir, there's peace that drinks the rain of Irish summertime and nestles and trembles in the wind, just like the rest of us. And then, and we who take the yoke of rest and find that mud and spittle leave us blind may learn to see trees walking over time if trees could grow from Cararua stones, or pass the sacramental sign of peace as if the dust were Eucharistic crumbs. For here, time passes like a pilgrim's rest and falls like sandwich crumbs on stones that catch as many grains of peace.
One of the finest North Carolinian poets we've ever had in all day. Next is an old favorite of ours. We love her, Mary. Mary.
You're not. For
the respect.
Wasn't it?
I think that's
what it is.
Hi, folks. It's a kind of special night because I have my American cousin and my sister-in-law, so I'm going to do something I haven't done for a while. It's called Dying Species. I was once a Celtic tigress with polished blood-red claws, itching to make things happen, looking for hidden flaws. The garden had pine decking. Our rooms were open plan, and we got 8 meg broadband when the whole damn thing began. I had a walk-in wardrobe, plus polished parquet floors. A woman from Slovenia helped out with all the chores. Antwerp for my diamonds, the Seychelles for my tan. At Dolce and Gabbana, my shopping spree began. That Harvey Nichols handbag, 2000, yes, that's true. Shoes had to be Manolo's, no other brand would do. I was not a yummy mummy. A Prius would be too twee. I preferred to burn up rubber in a spanking SUV. But then there came the credit crunch. Big cats were under threat. And even Eddie Hobbs couldn't get me out of debt. My eldest cub has lost his stripes, bit more than he could chew. With all his shares in free fall, there's no one left to screw. Too many hungry jackals have got us by the throat. And since now we've lost our opt-out clause, survival seems remote.
Thanks, Mary.
Can we make space at the back? Because Eugene Crowley is going to come.
Eugene.
Dublin, this is a passenger gift of crib straw. Never a short day. Litany of end games, countered by contra lessons. The poet James Kelly, Lord Sir Lewis. The Bishop of Derry and daughter, old friends. The marriage of Aoife, Princess of Leinster. Relocated, Sinead.
Thanks, Eugene. Delighted to hear you're reading English. No offence to Irish. Our next is Grant Marsh.
Life is change. We choose that change. It all depends on us. The very fabric of our society is under attack. The increasing demands of progress have made our thirst for information turn us into a fast food nation that rips the very threads that bind us together, and one by one they snap. We are beginning to experience a new isolation. Care for our society is waning. Our multicultural colors are fading. Our unique identities are paling. Coca-Colaization has left a permanent stain on the dress of our civilization. I'm trying to leave out bits, and that's friendly. We live in a world where Google is the new religion that we blindly believe has all the answers, and where the internet gradually kidnaps all our ideas, and it is only a matter of time before the ransom letters start appearing through our letterboxes. A bit left out there. Letter writing is now something that children marvel at behind the glass cases of museums. Our new communication is limited by 140 characters as we witness the digital emasculation of our languages. Soon no one will have the balls to say what they mean and will use goddamn smileys to show that we're keen. Mutilated messages litter, devoid of personality, litter our inboxes with misunderstandings. We fall out with friends. There are no soft landings. We will all live in towers of isolation, princesses whose only communication is done by tap, 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 tapping. We think we know who our friends are, but really we no longer recognize them, for their faces on Facebook are old and our memories have all become cold. Permanently turned on by the vibrations in our pockets, we will find to our cost when the signal is lost, that the contacts we are only figments of our imagination, and that without that damn phone, we are all alone. Our children learn to kill on 37-inch screens. They're all wearing headphones, so we can't hear the screams. And our living rooms have really become war zones in which our kids are fighting for their minds. The very terms of our existence have become an increasing list of obscure legal ease with conditions that we accept with incredible ease, and we sign away our lives with the tick of a pen, the tick of a pen, the tick of a pen. No one really knows all the contracts therein, and the small print lurks in the shadows. We spend our lives looking through a window that can unexpectedly shut down at any moment. The blue screen of death is the new disease. How many times must this happen? We have to forget to rely on reset. It's only a machine, and when support is withdrawn, you'll know what I mean. We think a television is for entertainment, but it's not that kind of box. It's the kind of box outside of which we cannot think. The revolution will be televised. And like hungry dogs, we will roam blood-soaked streets from the comfort of our armchairs, watching people die for their beliefs, while our politicians play the game of ping-pong blame, and we are political eunuchs who have reduced a republic of patriots to a republic of telly. There's a bit more. I can't remember, but anyway, so life is change, and we choose that change. It all depends on us. Let's choose wisely.
Thanks, Greg. Fair warning about the information age. Poet, novelist, friend of O'Gill, Patricia Walsh.
Okay, this is certainly a bit version of something. The twins are just taken to. They got a lift, and the person giving the lift turns out to be a very spiteful bitch. Oh. Although the sun was bright outside, with no hint of clouds in the horizon, the cabin was unwelcoming and dark. The only sign of light being the hissing of the kettle. Ah, just the thing, said Sheila. Kate, you're on tea today. What biscuits have you got for us? Coconut creams and no one like those. Sarah cut in. I thought you were vegetarian, Sheila. So I am. What are you? I'm a member of the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals and won't touch any animal from others, living, dead, or otherwise. Even if they are cunning the size of biscuits. Look at my bumper sticker. The crew looked at a rust bucket outside. It says, love me, don't eat me. Sounds like a great situation, all right. Well, stop shouting at odds that everyone doesn't agree with you. All vegetarians are hypocrites anyway. Everything in those biscuits were extricated and much stuff into poor innocent animals. I mean, why should we call some animals pets and some dinner? Or clothing? Well, should we burn a bucket of calcuts and some caskets and duck bubbles? Gaze interjected. Jesus drank wine and ate fish, and I'm sure that already broke had some animal products in it. In fact, it's sacraments regarding consecration and open interpretation to cannibalism and human sacrifice. Think about it. Sarah snapped. Well, Gandhi once said that the measure of a country's civilization can be measured by the way it treats its animals. Right, took a quick glance out the door. Well, the sheep in the next field seemed happy enough. Hitler was a vegetarian, I'm so guaranteed to her. We all know what happened there. It quickly dawned on everyone about Sarah that she had an uncanny knack to poison the atmosphere. Everybody was anxious to change the subject. In any case, as the chair Sarah Chainsmoke while driving must be getting tiresome, not to mention general bitchiness that spewed forth from her mouth every day. At break time, Paul decided to ask a quite obvious question that didn't stand at Sarah. What's the story with you and Greg? Are you nice him? Why? Who wants to know? Why are you so hard on Greg? Don't you even like him? Well, let's put it this way. I went to his nest, they've already handled him, and now his mother won't take him back. Greg approached them going past Sarah, who grimaced in his general direction. He came to the cabin with across the side with a broad beam in his face, brandishing his mobile phone. Woohoo, jubilated Greg. What's the woohoo about, snapped Sarah.
just got the phone call as Friday week. My friend, I'm going to take a drag at the faggot democracy. Well, that's a change, Swap Sarah. Only last week you were complaining you're picking your nose of destiny. What is it about? Well, I got called now and invigilated for local elections. I take out city cards and voting slip for people and give them voting cards. How does that sound? Well, it's taking place tomorrow week. All right, next Friday. Well, let's make a weekend of it. Come with me and celebrate. Celebrate? What? That you're actually making contributions to society? You are totally unable to contribute to society, so perish your thought now. Well, if you give me a chance, I promise you I'll be rich and famous and you're coming with me. Look, the 3 months I've been going out with you and it still hasn't happened. I still have to listen to this for so long. Why don't you drink yourself to death and be done with it? Where's poor Greg, said Paul. What a bitch, gasped John. Look, said Greg, I don't eat this crap every morning. I'm dying of lung cancer just being in the same car as you. Get a look for somebody else then. Fine, I will. Thank you.
Next up is Seamus Harrington, sporting a new beard and a new tan.
Thanks, Stephen, in solidarity with yourself. Hungry Hill Writing published it. Cutbacks. But it must run. We can't withdraw the course. It's expected, and enrolments are up. They've got a foot in the door. It's on the prospectus, subject to demand. A run on class materials? Rubbish. We'd be sued without a leg to stand on. Hand clapping and footstool step-ups and plimsolls were good enough once. Now we must put them all through their paces. We know the new floor permits only soft soles. There's a footnote here about that. But think of the cost. If you were a parent of centipede twins, who'd foot the bill? The board chairman will hear about this, I say. He's a weekly pedicuree, well known for his stance on PE and ability to think on his feet. Furthermore, his wife is a podiatrist, chief observer for the three-legged race and founding chair of the Alumni Association of Millipedes. Thank you.
Thanks, Seamus. Now, one of the finest writers that we have to grace us, Ciarán McCartan.
This is called The Space Between. If there is a heaven, then joy be to it. What a laugh that'll be. What a nice surprise when we finally shut our eyes. The beauty of the everyday is killed by expectancy. Who cares for this mortal world? I wait for paradise. The cause of consumerism and the capitalist laws have pulled our focus from what is to glorify what else. Drop what it is you have to hold, reach for the higher shelf. How much do I need to earn to live by my ideals? Which good book should I read to learn how enough feels? We have given up the space between to long the yards beyond. There will always be something else. Will we always be so fond?
Dreadful fame, John.
This is also a Sistina type thing. It's called Porto. I will praise her madness. What are you doing now? And now, and now, she cannot stop speaking. I am looking out my window from the hotel on Rua Pasus Manuel. I cannot see the Douro or the lamplights bathing the ships. I cannot see the pigeons crawling the streets for crumbs. I cannot see the tourists clinking their glasses of wine. Anasa, they say. It's very romantic. In my country, the evening brings the rain. We fell in love 8 years past. The window pane is right beneath my fingers. Mist rolls off the roofs and smell. I think I can smell some kind of industrial petrichor coming up through the tiles of the pavement. Here, winter holds the greatest solitude. Winter holds the greatest solitude. A woman sings fado for ungenerous tips, and fog moves over the face of the city, watching the drunks tumble down its steep hills, watching the senior students wrapped in black cloaks, hazing the freshers. They make them stand and kneel and bark like dogs. I will praise their madness. We fell in love 8 years past. The man in the bunk below mine cannot stop speaking. He wants to practice his English on me. He says, in my country, the evening brings the rainwater. He tells me he is in love with this city. Tonight he will walk along the river. He will see the lamplights bathing the ships, the barrels of port resting on board, lulled to sleep by the current. He will look up at the buildings which drift up the city. He will dream of its glorious past, when the ships were bathed in lamplight and the Douro bristled with sails, when women balanced baskets of sardines on their heads and tiptoed barefoot up the mosaic of streets, whispering about the coldness of winter and the greatness of their solitude. When the smell of sardines, lifted up off the river on open fires, was carried back by evening on the rain, when the fishermen, after eating their fill, got drunk in cafes singing songs of their madness, they couldn't stop singing. We fell in love 8 years past. Only 8 years. A whole 8 years. Her eyes dip and her breathing slows. She is wearing a vest, and only months ago I would kiss her shoulder and it was cool against my teeth. I cannot see the sun outside her window, but she is sweating beneath it. I am lamplit, blue against my computer screen. When I am awake, she is asleep and vice versa. It's geography. She says, try to feel happy. She cannot stop speaking. I say, you are there. Here, winter holds the greatest solitude. She looks out my window at the towers of the clergy, at the stale crumbling towers. She would praise their tripe and cold green soup, their yearning for the old days, their madness. In my country, she says, evening brings the rain. Evening brings rain, thick with dust humming off the window. We fell in love. It has passed. This is madness. I tell her about the city I cannot see, about the men having supper and playing checkers on the terrace, about the students serenading each other beneath the blankets of fog, about the ships bathed in lamplight, in the winter here, and the solitude. I cannot stop speaking. My roommate returns. In my country, he says, in my country, the evening brings the rain, I ask. He says, winter here holds the greatest solitude, this facade of granite, that quiet church. We fell in love 8 years past. The lamplight bathing the ships is a lure to reel the tourists in. The barrels are empty. The ships are static. We will praise her madness.
Thanks, Sean. If you're not familiar with The Penny Dreadful, then you should be. Also, The Penny Dreadful is responsible for one of the best Twitter feeds in Irish literature. Follow them. Follow them. Our next reader is Conor Pines.
Short. Ellis watched a woman approach to the rain. She wore a blue raincoat, one hand pulling the hood down over her face, solid boots. She came to the passenger window and he let it down. Are you free? She asked. I am, he said, hitting the meter. I sit in the back. Where to? He turned the radio low. Have a bit of a trip of your game, she said, as she took off her coat. He pulled out from the curb. He took the immediate right, cutting across the plaza and down Tucky Street. Water was pounding on the corner of South Main Street. He checked the meter. Are you on long? She asked. Just started, he said, making himself comfortable in the seat. You seem like you're in a good mood. We'll be picking up a 7 and a 5-year-old. He crossed Southgate Bridge and round by St. Finbar's and onto College Road. Some summer, isn't it? And my car is in the garage. Typical. But at least I won't have to water the plants. She directed him to a blue fence about 100 yards up on the left. He pulled into the drive. He turned while she made a dash for the porch. He kept the engine running to demiss the windscreen. He turned up the radio. A chef talking about 7 different ways to cook salmon. He turned it off. A lot was made for 2 cars. No lawn. Shrubs around the edge. Sun turning yellow. The meter ticked. The rain hammered on the roof. She was back after 5 minutes of coats and Wellingtons and directed him to the rendezvous bar. He headed straight for it. She talked about how her street was quiet and there were only foreign students around for the summer, and how she might be a bit early for the school. She noted his accent wasn't local. She wasn't from anywhere, she said. Any kids yourself, she asked. How old? What school? He glanced at her in the mirror. He went through an amber at the end of his cross, and when they got to the rendezvous, she wanted to park in the parking lot further up the road. Just drive beyond the rendezvous. There's a car park on the right. Here? Yeah. Ellis pulled in and parked the car facing the road and cut the engine. He looked at the meter. Without the wipers, rain filled the windscreen. Are you sure you don't want me to drive you up to the school? He said, turning in the seat to look at her. It is a bit wet, isn't it? And they're both in shorts. Ellis started the engine, pulled out into a puddle accumulating at the entrance of the car park. He looked at her in the mirror. Maybe I was a bit tad melodramatic, she said. Ellis looked. Ellis took the right at the first light and up the hill. She said it again, more to herself. Thin ripples of water the width of the road flowed down the hill and under the car. Hedges that overhung garden walls dripped. He watched her mouth. Anywhere here is good, she said, as they approached a high brick wall on the right. She hesitated leaving the cab. It's still quite early, she said, checking her watch. He watched her mouth. You're welcome to wait here, he said, looking at her in the mirror. She got out. He turned the Avensis and parked as close to the school gate as possible. He left the engine running for a while, then turned it off, and every so often hit the wipers and watched for the blue raincoat. The rain pummeled the cab and garden hedges. The gullies overflowed. He thought about the most direct route back across the city. They finally emerged from behind a tram of umbrellas, all 3 holding hands, wet. The 7-year-old in first, behind Ellis's seat. Hello, he said. Hello, she said. Did you say hello to the taxi man, her mother said. The country club, he confirmed, turning the ignition and moving off. Please. He turned onto Model Farm Road and eastbound back towards the city keys. She and the children nattered. She now sat between them. He took a glimpse in the mirror. They talked about only having sweets for lunch. She chastised him for not eating their lunch. They didn't care. They sang Pop Goes the Weasel. Ellis wondered which lane was the fastest. They sang it over and over. This must be worse than a Saturday night, she said, laughing. They both laughed. He changed lane. He looked at her. The river was high. She asked him, had he any holidays planned for the summer? Before he got a chance to answer, the little one behind the seat piped up. How old are you, Sean? She had gotten his name off the license display on the dash. Her mother reprimanded her for asking personal questions and using his first name. Leaves floated down the river. My mother's 42, the little one continued. He watched the woman shuffle on the seat, her ginger hair brush over her ear. Her name is Dr. Joan O'Malley, rheumatologist. She was smiling and looking down at her daughter. And her phone number is, not going to tell you that. Ellis watched her in the mirror. All my vital statistics, she said, and laughed without lifting her eyes off the child. He looked at her lips. She had a small gap between her teeth. And what's your dad's phone number, she asked the child. They took a ride at St. Luke's for the country club and went through the cream pillars and across the ramp down to the main entrance. The kids ran to the entrance. The woman paid, got out. Pop Goes the Weasel was spinning in his head. She covered her head with the blue hood. She walked away without looking back. Half a pound of tuppenny rice, half a pound of cream pillar. That's the way the money goes. Pop Goes the Weasel.
Thank you, Honor, and I hate to rush you all, but time is pressing, so I'll read those poems really quick now. Dear to your friend.
Nice. This is the shortest poem of the night.
Thank God.
So that's good. And it says, you are beauty. So, on the crest of a wave, there's a shining brightness. On the curve of a green leaf, a whiteness. You are beauty in its truest sense. Nothing you do can make that more or less intense. On the curve of a wave, there's a whiteness. On the crest of a green leaf, a shining brightness. Thank you.
That's fantastic. fantastic, one of the best new developing people we've had in Cedric. Yeah,
Cedric. Well, first of all, I just wanted to answer to you earlier from what you read earlier. Just this, humans are information mongers by design, floating in a sea of stimuli. Digitalism is the fingertip of the iceberg to a titanic potential. So, because that was also kind of the theme of my talk, here it is. It's called segmentation fault. Using the news as a route for radical thinking, I often find myself extrapolating beyond the boundaries of political correctness. Compassion is not a skill I properly integrate. Computation, however, is part of my system. Like everybody else, I've been pipelined through processes that mostly turn the hurtful into the heart, the hurtful into the heartless. Pain is a troublesome token I reduce to bits, conveniently sampled. Let's halt for a moment. I will. Who are they? What are we? They press each other and us into mean outcomes of endless loops without exit nor return value. As pointless as it is, I check again values. Constant bites sneaking out of memories into blackmails, secret hidden files, illegal operations. What are the probabilities that we are more than numbers and data when we are stuck in complex matrices where even the power of imaginary turns into a negative? I run that thought on a fixed point binary base until my own stack overflows. I then prompt input for this query. How could human machines remain uncorrupted while endlessly divided by zeros?
Thank you, Cedric. It's a pleasure to have him, teacher, poet, academic, amongst other things, Graham Allen.
Okay, thinking about what to read tonight. This is a poem, it's a middle bit of a poem called The Book of Job. I dedicate this to Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu. You fucking prick. From the point of view of a woman. When Sadar was born, we could smell the flowers wafted by hot drafts from the Judean hills. I knew then that the worst would happen. When we managed to unblock the doorway into the bedroom, now open to the street, we saw what looked like a rain-soaked coat pinned up on a nail against the far wall. The coat had no head, or say no hood. That took a considerable time to find. When we finally put the two together, the last piece of my heart fell into ruin. They put Sadar into a black plastic bag as the scent of frankincense and aloe wafted in from the bedroom's empty wall. The first word he said was mother. He would crawl patiently towards my ankles. When he stood without help, I wept. I knew that the worst would happen. He liked chocolate milk and raisins. His chuckle was like the summer sun. He had his father's noble face and all of his mother's aching heart. I would have given him sisters to play with and adore him. We marched him down our shattered street and put his tiny box into the earth. 1 week later, the jets returned and made a crater of his grave.
Guest is someone who will be known to some of you and not known to some others of you, Jimmy Collins.
figured as James brought this along, I'd read my poem that's in it, and I bet I can beat the shortest poem of the night. Big Book of Ireland. Declared in name only, legends has it, legends pass, never bestowed upon the handled buck or doe. A return in retrospect, yet to be judged directly, expanding from my island and ours, from the Inish. Add the pence to the cents, the pound to the dollar, and rest the liberty tree, the dying gulls and red deer, lost upon every tide and wind.
God, you gotta love brevity in a poet. Let's hope he's not brief. Christy Barker, wherever he is.
I'm going to have to be brief, unfortunately. This is a joke poem, so all you need to know about this, I've never read it in public before, it's called A Letter, and it's also, for those who care about such things, the second line rhymes with the fifth line in each verse. Other than that, it's a story of dashed dreams, broken heart, and dastardly betrayal. It's a very, very sad poem. Tomorrow is the first anniversary of that dreadful night when I came home to find your note telling me that after 5 years of love and cohabitation I would never see you again. I see my car, my television set, my skybox, my laptop, printer, camera, DVD player, and the 50 fucking quid you found in my coat. 3,000 rugs, a table and 4 chairs. I prized Warhol original of London's Blackfriars Bridge. 2 bedside lamps, a curtain, the Springsteen collection, and a toilet seat, for Christ's sake. What use to you were my size 10 shoes and my only suit? And how could you stoop so low as to take the last beer in the fridge? But at least you left me the vacuum cleaner. I assume you didn't know what it was, as you passed by the door. And you left the telephone bill with the mobile numbers of your brother in Sydney. 93 outgoing calls. Your sister in Vancouver, 86, your cousin in Cape Town, 79, and your uncle in Venezuela, only 30 calls. Don't you like him anymore? Since then, while hating you without vengeance, life has tortured me in your absence. For every day without fail, something will stir memories of you, such as my new kitten, totally cute, a ball of fun and mischief with widely guiding eyes. Last night sprawled across my lap, head resting on my stomach like you would do. She sat up, looked at me, and threw up her dinner, just like you. Running around like a blue-arsed fly was your catchphrase when you would frantically try to keep your order amidst your strife. And so it was that though a swarm of you had returned to claim the unfinished chicken supper that you thoughtfully stored beneath the bed alongside the half-devoured pizza, a symbolic reminder of the order's unfinished business that was our love life. That and your reverence for Luis Suarez, which had come to make me quite nervous of you, would cost me €350 in anti-tetanus injection and a 6-week antibiotic course. I could accept the loss of my heart and property, but on finding the bugging devices in every room, I called the guards. It was sympathetic, but they said you had already left the force. Thank you.
Christy, thanks for closing the night for us. A special thank you. Oh my God, Jesus, Donald, I didn't forget you today. Come up here and read us a poem really quickly. Really quickly.
How many minutes have I got?
Two.
Two? Two will do it. 1 minute introduction, 1 minute reading. I've been reading a part of this short story. And this is just a short section from the middle. It's a kind of a separate interlude. And it's a thought experiment where a panel has been assembled to decide the best piece or the happiest piece of music ever written by reasoning alone. So to do that, their memories are wiped so that they don't draw on their own experience of music. They just have to use reason to find it out. So they've already decided two things. The first thing is that happiness implies duration, so it has to be a long piece. And the second thing is that it must have been written by a happy person. So I'll read a short bit from there. So what kind of person is happy? Under the principle that the longer you live, the more surely sorrow will hunt you down, aren't young people the only possible candidates for more or less unadulterated happiness? none of our panel is young, and there is an air of wistfulness in the room. How young must a person be to be unscarred by real sadness? Quite young, the panel has to acknowledge. Even in the best case, quite young. That leads to the following question. What kind of young person is capable of writing an excellent piece of music? Well, a child prodigy, of course. Smiles light up the faces of our panel. And if a child prodigy is typically someone who is hectored by a domineering parent into the adult world before they are ready for it, then there cannot be many happy child prodigies. The panel lean forwards in their seats. It's exhilarating how quickly they are closing in on their goal. So in summary, a child prodigy capable of writing an extended happy piece of music of lasting interest. That must be extremely rare. In fact, for it to be possible at all, particular, easily identifiable conditions would be necessary. Only a certain kind of childhood environment was possible. Excitedly, the panel begin to sketch a profile of a prodigy born into a loving, secure family that had the means to nurture their child's musical talent and no need to exploit it. When they try to flesh out this family portrait, however, the question of social class and where the family's wealth might come from proves a stumbling block. To provide any meaningful description of the family's social background, they decide they would have to settle on an era first.
Last paragraph, Stephen. Fantastic.
An intense debate erupts, and some of the arguments put forward by panel members are skewed towards the eras they specialise in. However, eventually they agree that the most propitious setting for such a childhood would be in a bourgeois family, sometime after the liberations of the French Revolution and the upheaval of the Napoleonic Wars. The child should grow up breathing that special air of freedom which music should also have begun to claim. So in what era of music history, they reason, does music breathe optimism and hope? Well, the early Romantic period. And if they're going to settle for that period, and remembering that the music also has to be of lasting aesthetic value, where could a child have to grow up to be near the heart of the latest musical developments and a well-established musical culture? Indeed, what culture could we describe as preeminently romantic? Unanimously, the panel decide the child must have grown up in some cosmopolitan hub of modern-day Germany or the old Austro-Hungarian Empire at some time in the early 19th century.
Fantastic. Three big thank yous. The first thank you goes to the short story writers for keeping it short. Well done. Our second thank you is to Martin the Barman. He gave us drinks for a night. Well done. And James O'Sullivan.